I'd almost be willing to live my life over again. Almost. But I've told it all.
You're sure?
I'm quite sure. But ask me again anyway, won't you? I like that warm tone you had in your voice just then.
So did I.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back. This is another sparkling, I'm sure, episode of Let the Movie Speak. And of course, we are in the 1950s, and not just in the 1950s, Justin, but we are in what we are, I'm naming without even telling you beforehand. We are calling these episodes the Robbery Redos. We are in the Robbery Redos, folks.
Yes, a glistening redux of the glories of our past.
Yes.
It's our revenge tour, I think, was also branded about.
Oh, revenge redos. That's good.
Very happy to get back. And despite this intellectual property being sold and no doubt held for ransom, I'm still waiting to get the demand. But no doubt that's why we haven't seen them pop up.
Of course.
You know, for profit elsewhere on the dark web or other nefarious places.
Yeah.
But yes, an episode that, I think it went well last time.
Oh, so, man. If you could hear the first time we recorded this one, folks, it was a banger. And I don't know what's going to happen tonight, but...
Yeah, nothing pleases listeners more than hearing about how something that they cannot possibly access was really good.
If it makes you feel any better... We cannot possibly access it either. Maybe it sucked and we were just angry about the robbery.
We could be deluded completely.
Full of it. And we could be imagining things, Justin. We could be seeing and hearing things almost like the character in the movie Harvey, which is... That was a pretty...
You've still got it. You're still a pro,
I know.
Travis.
Slick seg. We're talking about 1950s. Harvey tonight.
Oh, is Jimmy gonna join us tonight?
Oh, well, he just poked his head in for 1 minute and we'll see. Okay, we'll see if he comes back.
Gosh, I hope he does.
I do too.
Love that man.
That guy's the greatest. Before we talk about Harvey, we're gonna tell everybody what we watched this week. Justin, what did you watch this week?
Well, Travis, I guess I can get rid of my script. I just finished, as listeners of this podcast, if they have listened before, thank you for one.
Seriously, thank you. The robber, though, that listened and then wanted more so bad that he stole our equipment and some fresh episodes.
And, I guess technically it's not a robbery because I think by the penal code that involves force or fear. I mean, I was fearful to hear the news.
That's true.
I don't think that, but the word thief just doesn't quite connotate. That makes me think of like Aladdin or something.
Yeah.
Like somebody stealing a loaf of bread. Nobody cares if you're hungry and you steal bread.
No. Yeah,
so I feel like robber is, it's emotionally correct. it captures the trauma.
Yeah. And he forcibly opened my unlocked trunk, which was,
unlocked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't put that part in the police report.
Of course.
Anyway. Yeah, what did I watch this week? Well, actually today, before I got off on my little rabbit trail, I was saying that listeners have probably heard us pontificate a little too much about Star Wars, but it's something that we both like.
If you hung in last week during the Obi-Wan the Obi-Wan black hole, I applaud you and you're welcome.
Yeah, maybe that's why we got robbed, Travis.
Yeah, probably. Probably that was
it. Might be like some Star Trek folk, some Trekkies gone
some
rogue.
Some Trekkies were like, it's enough, and they just took all of our ability to record.
Maybe that's why that graffiti was in there. William Shatner or bust or something.
Yeah, and it was in Klingon, which is a dead giveaway. I didn't even think about that till just now. Yeah,
it's all coming together.
Yep.
But so my children are also, for better or for worse, fans of Star Wars, thanks to a large part of my influence, I guess, and my wife's toleration. No, she does like it a little bit too, at least.
Okay.
But we finished, for the second time around, the animated show, Star Wars Rebels.
Yes.
Travis, I think I told you before, you know, hey, this show is actually, it's worth doing.
Yeah.
And, I still stand behind that, but with some caveats. I think, you know, if there's other Star Wars nerds out there, when content, newer Star Wars content like The Mandalorian or even the Obi-Wan show, mm-hmm. you know, they're starting to intersect now with some of these animated series and these characters that, you know, unless you had children or were just like a super nerd, you've probably never watched those shows. And quite possibly, even if you are a super nerd or yeah. you have children, you have not watched those shows. And so I think when people commend those, then the expectation among like a normal, more mainstream viewer is like, oh, if that's getting a commendation, this must be really excellent. But, you know, I think it really needs to be factored in. And it's very apparent watching these that while there are some moments, even sometimes regular moments of just kind of really solid and maybe at times profound artistic expression that is not really linked to children's entertainment or, yeah. you know, for adults. Overall, it is very much for children, you know. And the fact that my children are like clapping and cheering, you know, at ages like 9 and 6.
Yeah.
You know, during the finale of this show should kind of tell you that's, you know, that is the target audience. Mm-hmm. So they are trying to build a show. I mean, Rebels originally aired on Disney XD while that was still a thing.
Yeah.
For the first several seasons. But, so I would still give that recommendation, but honestly, I would not, I feel like it's not fair to just give to like a normal, like if you're a grown person
yeah,
and you do not have children that are going to really enjoy it and or you're not just like, I really want to know what's going on with Ahsoka. What's that all about? then you know what? It's not like required viewing,
yeah.
you know? But however, I think a lot of the fun and a lot of the joy for me is just seeing how much my kids just, you know, love it. And now that we have streaming, I'm not saying like that's a brand new technology, but compared to like when you and I grew up, you know, it's like every time an episode gets over, my kids are like one more. So,
yeah.
You know, it's fun. So anyway, I second time around, it is a blast, but I just want to, throw that out there that some of the, some of the things that I hear like on some of these websites, Travis, like yeah. these fan, you know, like, I don't know, comicbook.com or there's so many of these kind of like fan, like video game or movie culture kind of websites now
mm-hmm.
that, you know, just, there's a lot of like, I feel really elevated dialogue about you know, it's as if Shakespeare is creating the next Halo game every single time.
Yeah, of course.
And it's like, I mean, that's awesome. If people are enjoying it, that's great, right? That's what you want to hear, especially as the creator of these things. But it's like, you know, I think we do need to kind of come down and be realistic with our
sure.
maybe our praise and our expectations. But anyway, I would still pass it on for those that are interested or have children who might enjoy it. It's it's got, especially at a time when there's lots of discussion and folks upset for all kinds of various reasons about content in movies or kids things. Star Wars is still a pretty happy place and has some good life lessons, I think, that folks of all stripes can benefit from. So anyway, I'll climb off of the Star Wars wildebeest now and pass the baton to you, my friend. What did you watch this week?
I watched the newest Jordan Peele film.
Nope.
I did, though, Justin. I did watch
nope.
it. Yes, nah. Yes, I did. Oh, that's funny, because the name of the movie is Nope.
Okay.
So
I'm just tired of hearing you talking.
Yeah. Okay. So we had Get Out, which was his
yes.
debut, and it's this crazy big hit. He won Best Director, which is crazy for a first time mm-hmm. director. And
yeah.
and it's a horror movie, which the Oscars don't normally, you know,
right.
like give a lot of latitude towards. And then me and you saw Us, which was his
yep.
second film, which is super good. And like, you know, not perfect, but like, geez, you're watching that movie and you're like, this dude knows exactly what he wants to do. Like,
yeah,
he's really sharp as a director and stylistically distinct as a director too. Like, he's definitely got like classic influences, and he's at least up to this point, very much a genre guy. He's stuck to the horror kind of thriller world. And so then I went and was excited to see Nope because, you know, guys, two for two. His third movie's coming out. It's like, oh, this is probably going to be good. Here's what I'll say about Nope. And I'll try to be spoiler free because it's still a pretty new movie. By the time
And as we know, people that listen to podcasts only listen to them when they're brand new. So we're doing you a favor, listeners.
Bring yourself back to the July of 2022 when Nope was, in fact, in theaters film, fresh off of the reels, and I don't know if it was shot on digital. I don't know anything. Anyway, Nope is good. It's good. Like, it's very tightly directed, and it has that same kind of like, I don't know. He's got like a frenetic, like artistic storytelling energy to the way he pushes the thing along, and that's been true of all three of his movies. Nope is a little bit more like Spielbergian in its influence than like Us certainly was, or even Get Out, which felt a lot more like Rod Serling inspired or something like that. And there's a lot of good acting in it. But here's the weird thing, Justin, and I don't want to, I think you should definitely see it. I think you'll enjoy it.
Okay.
So I don't want to give away like the specifics, but Us is a pretty complicated story, I think.
Right.
Like, there's a lot of themes going on there. There's a lot of like weird open-ended symbolism at the beginning that ends up all meaning something in the end, and generally working towards the end of a very well-told story. Nope is a lot simpler. Like, it's not, he's not laying out all of these loose threads that he's then going to sort of weave together into this perfectly tight. Now, there's a lot fewer of those. And even still, like, I think it's probably less well juggled, which is interesting.
Odd, perplexing, even.
Yeah, like if you think about Us, there's probably like three or four like really dominant themes, and that he's you know, kind of trying the things he's trying to say with that movie, and he says them all very articulately. I think the only like sort of Achilles heel of that movie is the sort of over explaining some of those things in the third act.
Agreed.
But that's not like, you can't fault the guy for not saying something. He's saying plenty. And Nope, I think he's trying to say a more simple thing. And it's weird to me that that's almost handled a little less gracefully than his first two movies.
And when you say less gracefully, does that mean that in your viewing that the message seemed maybe more diluted or less powerful than it should have felt?
Yeah, a little bit, because I don't feel like, you know, I can think of a lot of moments in Get Out and a lot of moments in Us that are like good thrillery set piece moments. You know, you think about like the moment where they're stuck on the boat, and one of the like doppelgangers is like in the water, and I remember that distinctly being like pretty freaky and well executed. This is a lot more like there's mesas and more like actiony set pieces, like in a more like in a more Spielberg kind of a scale. But I think the through line, the like, what is he actually trying to say through this story is a little clunkier in the end because it gives a little bit of smaller scale over for being bigger scale. And that makes it harder to focus on what is super important about the story, I think.
That's too bad. That's a bummer.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is like, I think it's still really good. But this guy's almost like perfect up to this point in my mind. His third movie is a 3 out of 5 stars, which is not for me, you know, on Letterboxd or whatever. So it's like a good movie, but it's not, it's like most directors in their sophomore movie would try to do too much and it would be like a disaster. He tried to do a lot and it wasn't anywhere near a disaster, just a little, you know, kind of hinky here and there or whatever. And this one, it's like he's trying to do a lot less and it's less successful, interestingly. But definitely worth seeing. It's a smaller cast and some like ridiculously good acting. Without getting into spoiler specifics, just some really bad CGI that I didn't expect in a Jordan Peele movie. You know, like he didn't rely on that at all in his first two. And this one is, it's impossible to not see it and dwell on it. And it's just sort of, you know, like it doesn't do it for me. So
that's a bummer. I wonder, do you think, Travis, that, you know, because I don't think it's spoilery to say that, at least from my perspective, someone that hasn't seen it, but that has seen a few trailers, very clearly trying to at least lead the audience to believe aliens / UFOs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, is at play. And it's based on the kind of scale things that you're mentioning, doesn't really sound like that's something, like if you're going to see a UFO in the movie,
right?
It's going to be CGI more than likely if you're talking about that kind of scale. So that's kind of,
and that's not that. What's weird is like there's third act stuff with, I mean, if you've seen the trailer or whatever, it's like it's UFO. Okay. That's, that's not really a spoiler if you've seen the trailer, but that's not even what I'm talking about. There's a subplot that involves something very not UFO-sized that is, you know, I think an effective storytelling tool and like a thematic kind of mirror, you know, which he really likes to do, like have one thing happening over here and another thing. You know, Us is all about like mirrored storytelling, obviously. It's actually that that really took me. The UFO stuff, like the effects when it comes to the that bigger scale stuff, it's good. It's fine. Like CGI is okay because you're doing something that's not real. You know what I mean? Like
it's not possible.
Yeah. It's not like you're replicating something that we know. It's not like Luke Skywalker's face pasted onto somebody else. And you're like, that is not Mark Hamill. It's, you know, you have a lot of leeway there. This is something smaller and like more intimate and just, anyway, I think Nope is worth seeing. It's a solid movie that I just think like he's sort of kind of been perfect up to this point. And so it's not as good as the first two, in my opinion, but still pretty good and worth watching. And that is Nope. And speaking of things that are possibly not able to exist, Justin, should we introduce everyone to the 6 3.5 feet inches tall white rabbit known as Harvey?
I think you need to shift down or something. I don't know what. Yeah, let's do it. 1950s Harvey. Let's get into it.
Okay, well, that was a perfect, perfect segue. We've never had a better one. So we've got a Henry Koster directed film, 1950s Harvey, starring James Stewart. Good old
James
Jimmy
Stewart.
Yeah, this is 1950, so this is post It's a Wonderful Life. Wait, hold on. Is it? Yeah, that's like 48 or 9 or something like that.
I'm thinking maybe even a little, you know what, that's just so lame for somebody that already knows.
You know what, I think we should just keep guessing years. Yeah. I think...
How about 46? Because I feel like it was
46, you're right.
His first, oh my gosh, what's the director of that movie? I'm forgetting.
Frank Capra.
Thank you, Capra. Wasn't that his first movie when he got back from the war?
Yeah, his first post-war movie. That's right. Yeah. So this
anyway,
is
but that's not the movie we're talking about today.
No, of course not. This is a few years later than that. Henry Koster, if you care about film credits and whatever, he's like a very solid working director in this era, and you know, he started like mid late 40s and worked all the way through the early 60s. I don't know a lot of the other movies on his filmography, but they're names you would know. Like, I mean, things like My Man Godfrey and, My Blue Heaven. And, you know, there's just a lot of them. He did like
a lot of my movies.
A lot of my,
yeah.
Something called Married by the Stork in 1932. Anyway,
classic.
Everybody loves Married to a Stork. Married to the Blue My Stork from Heaven.
Heavenly
Stork love.
Good. Well, that's the end of our episode today, folks.
We've both had strokes. And anyway, this guy was like solid working, kind of workmanlike director, but he never was Frank Capra level or anything like that. This was a Broadway play that won a Pulitzer Prize, written by Mary Chase, and it starred none other than Jimmy Stewart and Josephine Hull. They were carried over from the original cast, and she helped adapt this thing along with Oscar Brodny. And what do you have to say about Harvey? It's like a dramedy of sorts, don't you think, Justin? It definitely, it sort of weaves, I think, sort of equal parts farce, kind of farcical comedy elements, and I don't know, not like melodrama, but like life lesson-y sort of
a little bit didactic kind of, or it's but you know, you mentioned the farce. I mean, we might as well talk about the first scene or couple scenes right there. There is some really great it's not all physical comedy, although there's some amazing physical comedy.
There's some really good physical comedy,
that exists there. But just the writing is very snappy, and I'm thinking of the scene where Vita is talking to the doctor on the phone. You know, it's just, it's genius. And there's really something to be said, I think, for, you know, clearly we've done a lot of movies, Travis, so far anyway, that, are from maybe the golden age or the silver ages of Hollywood.
Yeah.
And, I'm, because you and me, you know, like these movies so much, and this is just like the way it sounds like you grew up and the way I grew up. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, is this movie in black and white? You know, it was just like, movie's a movie. We're going to watch it. You're going to like it.
Yes.
And, because I was tired of the spankings, I chose to like it. and, you know, so now, but because I love this stuff so much, I feel like it's, you know, just part of my blood, I guess. I like film.
Yeah.
When I find myself talking to other folks about film, I just kind of, assume that, like, if you like film, then, oh, you know what? You'd probably like this movie. It's from, you know, oh, it's Akira Kurosawa, you know. Like, I remember I was talking to somebody, you know, in a kind of a group setting. We had a small group. This was like a work conference thing.
And
talking to a couple different people about movies, because it sounded like there were some common interests, and a couple people were talking about some foreign movies. And so I said, you know what? If you haven't seen Stray Dog, which is an episode we did, right, Travis?
Yep.
Akira Kurosawa, 1949, you should check it out.
Not a bad movie, yes.
And one guy that was part of the group was like, wow, I just feel so, like, uncultured, and like, wow, these are really old movies, you know. And I don't say that to make that person sound stupid at all. It's not my point. It's a very normal, cool person. But I just thought, oh, this is really, that is kind of... In case you're listening to this and you're like, why would I ever bother watching this movie?
Yeah.
I would just encourage you, like, that's what I'm trying to get at with this first scene, couple scenes in the comedy.
Yeah.
Like, if it's done well on film and it works, it's not like, oh, but it worked back then. I mean, that exists in certain niche senses, I think, of different things that we allow to kind of pass today. But largely, I think people are people, and good storytelling, even in 1930 or 1920, is good storytelling in 2020. And I don't know. So anyway, that's my little plug for, you know, love art. Go love art, people.
Go love art. You know, and the Academy had a little love for this movie, too. It got a couple nominations, both for acting for Jimmy himself. And Josephine Hull playing Vita won, which is, I don't know, Justin, this is not the kind of win you would see today. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh my gosh.
It's like,
yeah, but I think that, you know, how I was just going blah 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 about like how things don't change. I don't think the Academy's changed much, Travis.
Yeah.
They really, I mean, yes, they're not going to nominate excuse me, what's the movie I'm looking for? Get Out.
Right.
Back in 1950, right?
Yeah.
So that's not, I don't mean that nothing, when I say the Academy doesn't change, I don't mean nothing in our culture has changed at all. I'm not trying to make some crazy overgeneralized statement. But I mean specifically that the Academy loves to nominate people and things that make the Academy feel good about itself.
That's true.
For the time that it's living in.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
And so I think in 1950, it made the Academy feel really good to see a character like Vita and go, oh my gosh, didn't she do wonderful? Let's give Josephine an Oscar.
Yeah.
You know, just like it made them feel good to give Jordan one in 2020. So here's my also plug for, like, love the art, but don't love the Academy.
Because
I'm not saying the Academy is like evil or something, but they are not the be all end all. They're just a body, a voting body.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They don't get to choose for you if it's good or not, but they chose Harvey.
They chose Josephine Hull. And I mean, you could kind of see Jimmy Stewart getting a nomination for like almost anything. Cause he has the just like, he's got the likability factor. It's like, I don't know how you don't nominate Meryl Streep when she's in a movie because she's just charismatic and, you know, which is why she has like 17 nominations or something. But I just think it's an interesting win because you think about like an older woman in a basically comedic role supporting. Like, that's not like the kind of supporting actress nominations we see most of the time are they lean towards the dramatic, like almost always. And, and I don't know, it's an interesting win.
Cause it's not, don't you think it's interesting, Travis? Cause it's not a particularly, I'm not trying to take any credit away from Josephine Hull. Cause I think she does do a very good job in this movie, but I maybe I'm alone, but I don't myself see like a ton of meat on this character or just like, oh my gosh, the pathos.
It's very one note. Yeah. It's very one note. She's like, the whole movie is her just going like, oh my goodness gracious me. Like, and you know, like, I'm not saying that it takes no talent to do. I think it actually takes a lot of zhuzh or whatever to keep that up over the course of an entire movie. That's a high energy role, and it's not easy to do that and not be annoying, which she isn't. So that's an interesting win. I think the Jimmy Stewart nomination is a little bit more predictable, but warranted. I think, you know, I've seen a lot of Jimmy Stewart movies, and this is right near the top for me. This is near It's a Wonderful Life territory. I think he's really, really good in this. It's just well cast. So that's some of the background, a little bit of the feel of the movie. And now we need to ask the most important question, which is, what's it saying? I mean, it's not the most plotty movie in the world. You can kind of feel that it's adapted from a play, and yet I think they make really good use of it not being on stage. Like, they do stuff in the movie that you're like, oh, there's no way that was a scene in this stage play, because the there's too many locations. You know, there's the whole thing with the gate, you know, like the electric gate,
right.
That, like, I'm like, I just don't buy that they did that. Like, they didn't need it on stage, and so this just like making a good use of the medium when they did the adaptation. I think the fact that the Pulitzer-winning playwright came along to adapt the screenplay is a good call.
when you can do it, I always put my money on the Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah, it's a good bet. And, you know, like, some adaptations, like, we've talked about adaptation a lot on this podcast and several seasons and lots of genres and whatever. And I just think There's a deftness to how you either decide to make something feel distinctly stagey and then film it, or make it feel like a movie and don't carry over the stagey things that are going to feel weird in the film. Like, you know, we talked about Rope, and Rope feels very stagey. You know, it's one location the whole time. They try to do the one shot thing, which sort of replicates your experience in a theater. And this is just like, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to keep the snappy writing. We're going to keep all the themes and the characters strongly, you know, intact, but we're going to make a movie. And I think that Koster does a good job behind the camera and the director's chair for that reason. And all the actors, you know, a couple of them are carried over from the play. And then there's a bunch of film people in here too. So this story, Justin, is immediately, right, we get introduced to our lead. We get introduced to Elwood P. Dowd.
Oh, Jimmy here?
That sounded more like Tom Brokaw than it did.
He's introducing. Yeah, it's for
Ladies
his
and
segment.
Gentlemen, Elwood P. Dowd. anyway.
That sounds like Tom Brokaw.
And, you know, you get introduced to him to this very cursory first scene where he comes out and the mailman is there delivering a package, and he says, you know, oh, hi, Mr. Mailman, and, you know, let me give you one of my cards. And he's already letting the door open for the invisible rabbit named Harvey, who is his best friend, and he's opening the gate for him. And you get everything kind of in that first 3-minute sequence. And before we talk about some of the plot mechanics that kind of move the story along, Justin, I think like we get introduced to Jimmy first. Let's talk about Jimmy first, which is this bit of casting is the film's like absolute ace in the hole, right? Like this character is seemingly, it wasn't really written for Jimmy Stewart. He actually started playing this role because the lead guy on Broadway was sick. And so he stepped in.
That lead
in.
Guy was Tom Brokaw. It's weird. Yeah. Just yeah, it's all connected. Yeah.
It was really weird. Tom Brokaw was 4 years old, I think, at the time. And
leading man. We use that term loosely.
Yeah, but they had to change his diapers between scenes at 4 years old. So
it was too much.
He's not
too
advanced. Much. Yeah.
I'm not dealing with this prima donna. Get me Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. He wears grown-up underwear. What are we talking about? Jimmy Stewart is so well cast in this movie. It is the perfect sort of like play to your just wonderfully genteel, sympathetic, warm, everyman. It's almost like weird. You know, we talked about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And then I think in that episode, Justin, you talked about how that was his first film post-war. It's a Wonderful Life, rather. It was his first film post-war. And he's like, and you were talking about to see the transformation on his face is really sad. You know, it's just right there. And what's interesting about this is aesthetically, it's the same face, but he's sort of like does a complete roundabout character-wise almost, you know. Between It's a Wonderful Life and this guy's the eternal optimist. He's the eternal, I'm going to make friends with everybody and be kind to everybody and just see the good in people. And I don't know. What do you have to say about Elwood P. Dowd played by Jimmy Stewart?
I think without Jimmy Stewart in this role, we don't know what we don't know. And so we have no idea of knowing, could any other actor have made this movie, you know, what it is today, which is at least among film people, I think. A revered movie. I think he is the secret sauce and secret weapon and barbecued flavored that makes this machine really work. And with regards to him, his actual presentation or affectation as an actor, I think because Jimmy Stewart can do the everyman, he has a similar quality to like a Mr. Rogers, right?
Sure.
To like a Fred Rogers. Sure, sure. Just this really likable, very... not a charming in a weird, like suave kind of way, but just like an endearing personality.
That's it. Yeah.
Somebody that you'd really want to be around. And so I think that allows him just by being who he is, just being Jimmy Stewart, he is allowed to make you feel very sympathetic to this guy who I think like if somebody like Spencer Tracy tried to play this character. I like Spencer Tracy, but he would just look nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd just be like, this person is absolutely gone bananas and the bananas have gone to seed.
Yes.
Which is the worst. Don't ever have bananas that have gone to seed.
No, it's bad.
It's really, really There's atrocious.
There's so many
tasting.
Seeds everywhere, banana seeds. I mean,
oh my gosh, don't get me started about those bananas. I think that really sells this story because the whole crux of this, right, is that how does this guy who seems so nice and he seems so decent, but he sees this rabbit that isn't there or he claims he does? We have to cure him of this, right? But if you look at every other character in the movie, and they're all concerned about that. There's good characters. I guess I'm talking more in like some really general moral statement. There's good characters and there's bad characters.
Yeah.
And Jimmy is clearly the best. Elwood P. Dowd represents like the best of humanity.
Yes.
But he has this really weird thing where he is... is it because he's a drunk? I remember on the episode we did before, which you'll never hear, listeners.
Never.
We had a really good discussion about whether or not he was actually drunk. But whether or not he was, it's like the conclusion of this movie where they're discussing, if we give him this like medicine or this injection, we can make him not see the rabbit and he'll be like everyone else. And they realize... oh, wait a minute. We don't want him to be like everyone else.
Yeah.
We want him to be him. I mean, he represents some, even if there is this weirdness, this like rabid eccentricity of a guy that thinks there's a 2-meter tall rabbit following him around. I don't want to lose everything that is about him. I do not want him to become another character that's in this movie that's just either a slave to their work or a slave to social convention.
Yeah.
Elwood P. Dowd's not a slave to anything except just being decent, to being loving to his fellow man.
Yeah.
And to me, that you can't sell that point the same way without being... I feel like Jimmy allows us to focus on that. And that part being played by anyone else, I have a really hard time feeling like that is the point of the movie instead of, is he drunk or is he not?
Sure. Yeah, I agree. You know, on the rewatch, which, you know, my experience with this movie, Justin, is I watched it when I was very young because my mom, again, is this like super fan of Jimmy Stewart. And so we had all those VHS tapes. And this was, you know, I remember the sepia toned one of him sitting with the shadow of the bunny kind of next to him on the wall. And I didn't pick up on any of this stuff, like any of the real deep themes when I was younger. I was just like, oh, he's, you know, affable, lovable Jimmy Stewart. And there's some funny.
Yeah, and then you went off and played with Tom Brokaw as a child. I know, Travis.
Of course, I
heard it a thousand times.
He's like, "Got me the Legos." Okay, now he's having digestive issues.
Tom Brokaw's having problems.
Settle down, Tom. The second time I watched this, it's impossible just from like the original playwright, you know, doing what she did and then adapting it and keeping everything that's most important to her, you know, which I think is very clear that like. I think any reading of this movie that includes a like, okay, Harvey, the big invisible rabbit that everybody wants him to rid himself of is like alcoholism or something. I think it's almost impossible to deny that completely. Like the parallels are just too consistent. Like there's too many times where he's like, let's go get a drink. I'll bring Harvey. Let's, you know, it's too many times. However, I don't think that is like necessarily authorial intent or something like that. I think the most important thing about the story is what you say. It's like, here's a person who is the best of us. Do we want to take away his weird thing that we as society view as weird in order to make him not weird to us, but maybe he won't be the best of us anymore. You know, I think we gotta work through the plot a little bit because some of the farcical like misunderstandings and stuff, they're just stinking delightful, and they play into...
Stinking delightful. Not like those rotten bananas that have gone to seed, though. Gosh dang it, I don't even want to think about those bananas. Let's talk about the plot instead.
The smell of those keeps me up many nights.
Tom Brokaw. Leave Tom out of it, yeah, Travis. I'm trying to talk about Harvey.
It's a strong banana musk. No, he's gone. He's left me.
Tom, I told you to get out of here.
So the story starts.
It's like his helper. I'm not sure what that
is. Exactly. His valet. Get out of here, Tom. And it's like Sylvester Stallone for some reason.
Anyway, let's not do that. Let's talk about the plot.
We're already doing it. He is, Elwood P. Dowd is in this movie, played by Jimmy Stewart. And, he has a friend who's a rabbit, allegedly. Anyway, Vita is played by Josephine Hull. That's the whole plot. His sister Vita has a daughter named Myrtle May, which is the most like stagey name.
Myrtle May?
Yeah. Trying to find her a suitor, a husband, and the thing that starts to happen is, you know, this big rabbit in the room, elephant in the room, if you will.
Starts, I see what you did there.
Yeah, I did. Starts to make social situations awkward. And so they finally decide, like Vita finally decides in that conversation you were talking about to the doctor, to the judge, rather, to Judge Omar Gaffney, who is their lawyer. That guy has the most amazing 1950s voice in the world. He's like barking at his underling when she says, you know, stop Elwood, you know, before he gets to this party. And he barks at his underling guy and he's like, find him in the park. Find him in the park. Don't let him get there. You know, it's like it sounds like it's literally being recorded on a radio and then put into the movie or something. They're going to commit him to a sanitarium, essentially. And so
that's what we used to call places where we sent people to receive drugs and abuse.
Yeah. Which is, you know, this is a pretty delightful movie, but that is made very clear and very,
right.
And really, just all too casual terms.
Well, because even the scene where Vida, right,
yes,
is there's that case of mistaken identity and the orderly that, you know, comes into play more as, well, more of an important character.
The doctor, you say mistaken identity, and I don't mean to rush in and correct you.
You go for it.
The doctor basically just decides, oh, you're crazy, not your brother. Let's lock you up and let him go. It's like,
right? No, you're right.
It's very weird.
That's darker, but it's played like a little bit of black comedy,
like farce. Yeah, and it is. Yeah,
and she's taken upstairs to like her sanatorium room by this guy, and she calls him a white slaver. And then she kind of insinuates in very 1950s terms that, you know, I'm not trying to say that he was like, you know, there's like sexual abuse or something, but, you know, she's communicating that his intimacy with her, because he's probably, you know, as an orderly in the 50s, probably getting people undressed or whatever and put into whatever scrubs they wear in the sanatorium.
A tub. She says he throws her into a tub.
Yes. So, you know, but that is all played for laughs,
right?
You know, and it's like, gosh, I wouldn't want to send my worst enemy there, I don't think.
Yeah.
And here we are just making light of it. So I don't know, Travis, what your take is, but mine is that's a little bit of, maybe two things. One is just trying to be comfortable and make light of something that just exists.
Right.
I mean, JFK's dad, committed one of his, kids, his daughters, to mm-hmm. a sanatorium, so got her a lobotomy. But anyway, I'm just saying that's happening in the same kind of time and space,
sure,
as this movie. And so it's like, maybe this is an attempt to go like, yeah, this is not good what we're doing, but it's, you know, it's happening, so maybe we can make a joke out of it,
right?
But also maybe it's trying to be a little bit of a commentary on that, because
yeah,
there's nothing really funny about a sanatorium in real life. Just like there's nothing funny about a guy who is ostracized from society, even though he's perfectly good,
mm-hmm,
or ostracized from society on the other side of that coin because he's an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's just this, you know, I don't know what your take is on which of those, or neither.
I think
that might.
What it makes me focus in on is the Dr. Raymond Sanderson character, who's played by Charles Drake, and his character is sort of just like emblematic of that location and that culture or whatever, because he's the one, right, who like they arrive and Vita's like, I want to see Dr. Chumley right away.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like,
mm-hmm,
Dr. Chumley doesn't see anyone. You know, I see all the patients. And he again makes this sort of, I mean, he's a psychologist, but like he makes a snap decision when she starts explaining what's wrong with Elwood. Oh, this is he says to Miss Kelly, the nurse, he says, oh, that's the oldest excuse in the book, telling me everything that's wrong with her brother, because she's actually the one who needs to be committed. And I'm like,
right,
what are you talking about? I don't think,
yeah,
like, is that really a thing? That sounds nuts. But his character arc to me is like the most solid ground for whatever it might be trying to say, or trying to sort of fluff off about the sanitarium, right? It's like, his character starts off in the first scene you see him in is he's such a jerk. He's like, he's very short and curt and rude to Miss Kelly. And he's very, snap judgment-y with the Dowds. And then as the movie goes along, that completely changes. Like he is the biggest bend to his arc of any of the characters in this movie, because he starts out very hard-nosed, very judgmental, and very sure of himself, and he's the one passing judgment on whether people are okay mentally or not, you know, and Elwood being the main kind of subject of that. By the time the movie's over, even though this place, you know, has been depicted as like probably one of the nicer sanitary, it doesn't look like Arkham Asylum or something, you know, it's like it looks tidy and like clean,
right,
and the people there aren't seemingly monstrous, except for when, you know, the thing happens that you already mentioned. It's just interesting to me that his journey, when he comes into contact with Elwood and when he learns to like just remember that people are like worth loving again or something,
Yeah.
It's like one of the most poignant things when they have that dance scene together in the bar, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
He's chasing around Elwood because he thinks Elwood needs to be recommitted because they made this mistake and accidentally locked up the non-crazy person. And, you know, they sit and they talk with him for 5 minutes and just get a little taste of who he is and how he sees the world. And he's like, why don't you two dance together? You know? And then they dance.
Is that Tom Brokaw? Yeah. I've been looking for him.
That was Jimmy. Thank you very much.
Oh, sorry, Jimmy. I got that wrong.
It's a simple conversation and dance, and he just looks at Miss Kelly, this person who he's been really awful to in the preceding scenes, and he just sees her again. You know, he just sees her clearly, and she's loved him and sort of puts up with his stuffiness, and in that moment they're dancing together, and he just sees her, and then they talk in the alleyway with Elwood, and they get a little bit more. I don't know,
there's the Bee Gees number in the background. It's all good.
Everybody dances disco, which is way ahead of its time.
way ahead.
Yeah, that's what the real Oscar nomination was for, best disco performance. Like, you can't argue. What is inarguable about this movie is that it makes you feel good when you watch it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, even though it contains that weird kind of anachronistic stuff in it, maybe about the sanitarium and maybe just, it's sort of anachronistic in the way it handles talking about drinking at all. It's like drinking is just all the time, middle of the day, anywhere, anyone, let's have a couple. And I think you could read into that, but I think more than anything, it's just a time period thing. And
I agree.
I think that's the goal, right? I think that's what it is saying. I think Mary Chase is really trying to say, like, just look at this person who is the best of us. He's the best slice of humanity you might imagine. And, you know, like, relax and be present with people. And that's sort of it, you know?
And like when you're talking about with Dr. Sanderson, I'm 100% with you that it's really telling that his whole arc as a character, his turn as a character, which is just a progression from kind of like a doofus to like a did it right. Good job.
Yeah.
It's because he comes into orbit of Elwood, who is this guy who makes him realize, you know, oh my gosh, I should open my eyes. I'm so blinded by the stuff that is maybe a part of our, and I'm not trying to read, like, I apologize if it sounds like I'm trying to put a bunch of like 2022 crap into this movie. And by crap, I just mean stuff that, you know, methods of like dissecting or criticizing art that did not exist then. I'm not saying that stuff is useless. I'm just saying it's not my point to try to, like, you know, fire shots back at 1950 or something.
Sure.
And say, haha, what a bunch of jerks. My point is that he seems to actually have that change to him only because he comes into contact with someone who is outside of the outside and kind of above the cultural moment. Right. And it's not Elwood would be the same in 1750, in 1950, and in 2050. Notice I skipped 1850 because he would not have been the same. He would have been all over the cotton gin. He would have been filing patents. It would have been nuts.
It would have been crazy.
That would have been different. He'd also try to be doing the disco thing back then, and it just wouldn't have gone well for him. But I think that is a, when we talk about like discussions, Travis, I'm with you that you cannot just get rid of the alcohol thing.
Sure.
You can't say, oh, that's nothing. No, it's there. But I agree with you that it's not just an open and shut kind of like, well, clearly this is what the movie is saying. And I think that is the credit to Chase's writing and why things like this stand the test of time. Because it's not, it's oftentimes those movies and stories where it's like, it really makes you think and go, well, I know it's saying this, but is this alcohol thing? Like what is that all about? And I think that's what gives it some stronger legs holistically and with even Dr. Sanderson.
And like rewatchability, right? Because like you can watch this movie and just sort of like just do not read alcohol into the themes. Just don't, right? And then you get this, like what we're talking about now. And then honestly, like it's a eminently rewatchable movie. It's just really paced really well, and every scene is sort of delightful. But like if you go back and you try to put on those glasses and watch it that way. It is really weird and interesting to think about it as an analogy for, like, you know, dependence on alcohol or habitual drinking or something. But, like, I don't think that's the dominant purpose behind it. But it is weirdly interesting to watch it that way. I think as a lot of good playwrights are wont to do, the thesis statement of this story and what it's really saying is there, right? I think it's in mm-hmm. this line that Elwood says. He says, years ago, my mother used to say to me, she'd say, in this world, Elwood, you must be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. And he says, well, for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant. You may quote me. You know, it's like literally like the playwright breaking the fourth wall for a moment, you know, and just telling the audience, like, this is it, people, you know. And I don't think you can really argue your way out of that one as far as a thematic reading of the story.
And you know, I think for me it comes down to, as far as readings, that final scene when it appears that Harvey's going to stay with Dr. Chumley.
Yes.
Right? So he can kind of take him on this, like, fantasy, just a really vain fantasy, too. It's not like there's no, like, higher purpose there. It's just a very kind of...
it's a really sad scene, Justin, when he explains what he wants. Like, he says, Harvey can stop the clock and you can go anywhere you want, and the clock will be the same when you come back. And he explains what he would want, right? This doctor of medicine is, like, enchanted by this idea, and he just says, like, I would go to Akron, Ohio, and I would sit on a picnic blanket and order cold beer and have a beautiful woman by my side, and I would tell her things I've never told anyone. And then Elwood literally says, well, I think you're making a mistake by not letting the woman talk. You know, like, it is very vain. Mm-hmm. Okay, please go on with the ending, though.
No, and so, you know, Elwood is like, asks Harvey, well, you want to stay with him? Okay, I guess he does. Okay, so, and then Elwood walks out, right? And it looks like he's still Elwood. He hasn't been injected, but it appears like Harvey has left of Harvey's will to go stay with Chumley. But then as Elwood's leaving the sanitarium, the gate, like, swings open, like, with no one there.
Yeah.
And then Elwood talks to Harvey, you know, saying, like, I prefer you too. And then they follow them. So it's just like, you know, if it was just a strict, just eccentricity or alcohol thing, any of those theories that are too strict, I think that last scene just pulls the rug out.
It does.
It's like, okay, I guess there is something a little bit extraordinary or supernatural.
It is some kind of a fairy tale. Like there, and I don't, like you said, I don't think that last sequence leaves it like any imagination there, really. I mean, we've been told, like, in the story, this is a puka, right? Which is, I don't know a lot about, like, what Celtic history, but like, it's
shame,
like,
on you.
Excuse me, but that's like a like long told historical, like, sort of folklore thing about, like, an animal that is mischievous but innocent or whatever. And so she's weaving this stuff in, like, pretty solidly. It's not just like, oh, you've never heard of this before. It's sort of like talking about a vampire and then having, you know, a vampire be looming in the shadows. It's like a real thing in literature and storytelling, whatever. But yeah, there's no question, right? When the gate opens, like, Harvey opens the gate.
Right.
Harvey is real. Like, there's, we know by the end. You talked about the snappy writing, and so I just want to highlight a couple of the quick exchanges that I think are, they're so good, and I think they're emblematic of this decade where we're sort of, in a lot of ways, especially with comedies and, like, family movies or, like, big audience pleasers, we're post-noir in a lot of spaces, right? Where dialogue isn't really, like, heightened and melodramatic. Right. It's just sort of, like, good and witty. And the bartender talks to another guy at the bar, and the guy at the bar says, is he alone? And Mr. Cracker, the bartender, says, well, there are two schools of thought, sir. Like, that's just, like, that's just good, you know? And then at one point, Wilson, who is the orderly who baptizes Vita, he says, who's Harvey? Miss Kelly says, a white rabbit 6 feet tall. Wilson says, 6 feet. And Elwood says, 6 feet, 3.5 inches. Now let's stick to the facts. Like, it's really good. Like, it's almost Blink and You'll Miss It funny stuff. It's like, it's consistent, like, throughout. Like, you can watch this just for that stuff and be really satisfied.
Yeah, I agree. And it's not, that was something that wasn't just received by you and me, but even at the time this movie was written, which, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Travis, I don't think this was even up for any writing.
None.
Awards, which is not even nominated anywhere, not just the Academy, but because it was praised everywhere that it was reviewed.
Yeah.
I know I was able to find one snippet from Variety, I think, from back in the day.
Yeah.
It praised the transition, the written transition from, you know, the play to the screen, and how so much was carried over that was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always the case, as we talked about with our favorite time travel movie, Somewhere in Time. Sometimes things that are like work really well on the page or the play, for reasons unknown, they get left out.
Yeah.
And God bless Mrs. Chase for not leaving the soul out of this movie, because to me, Travis, this movie succeeds because it's a good movie. And that's a really simplistic statement that combines a lot of really complex stuff that makes a movie work.
Totally.
I agree with you, man. You make me excited, even though we both watched it, you more recently than me again. But it makes me excited just talking about it to go watch it again. It's just that kind of movie.
Yeah, rewatchable for sure. Before we get into our wrap-up, I just want to highlight that one scene where they're like, they've got him in the back room already. They're going to give him Formula 977 or whatever. And he's like, basically, I don't want to do this. And then he's Vita's just like, oh, please, Elwood, please. And he's like, okay, Vita, if this is what you want, you know, and then he decides to go do it for her. Basically that taxi driver, right, is the one who ends up talking them out of it. The taxi driver has the scene stealing moment of the entire movie. He has a great, like, long line where he explains, like, I've driven people here before the shot and I've driven them away after, and this is what to expect. His last line before he just walks out the door and shuts it is, like, not after this. He's going to come out of there a perfectly normal human being, and you know what stinkers they are. And then he just leaves.
Yes.
It's like,
yes,
it's like exactly what she wants to say, and also, like, so snappy and well-delivered and tonally correct for the movie.
Well, and where the phrase mic drop originates, which was kind of puzzling back then, but the cab driver pulls a microphone out of his pocket after he says what stinkers they are, and extends it out at eye level, drops it, and turns around and walks away. So, and really cool just for that kind of
historical
fact. They pan
to a crowd, which is just like losing their minds, like, oh!
Oh, damn! Yeah, it's really cool.
Well, we didn't let the robbers win, Justin.
Those stinkers.
Little stinkers.
Must have been perfectly normal human beings.
Perfectly nice, normal, cool dudes who stole all of our stuff.
How do you know they were men, Travis?
Dudes is not gendered, as last time I checked. We watched Harvey. We recorded an episode on Harvey 2 times, and these are our final thoughts, people. Harvey is great. It's worth watching. This is one that I could definitely see watching annually and be like super satisfied. And I mean, like, my kids watched the last half hour of this with me and kind of enjoyed the goofiness of it. I don't know if I'd want them to watch Vita explaining what happened to her in the sanitarium, but like, other than that, you can kind of watch it with anyone. And it's got a lot to say. The Jimmy Stewart performance is so good. It is, like, honestly, if I had to pick one performance of his career and just say, like, this is what you get when you put him in the perfect role and he just delivers, It's a Wonderful Life is amazing. But I think this might be it. Like, this is Jimmy Stewart. It's almost like we always talk about Harrison Ford being the guy that they cast for in a very specific way, because he brings his own charisma, his own energy, his own kind of wit and timing and all of that likability. This is, to me, this is that Jimmy Stewart performance if you're looking for it. And it's a classic. It's good. I would recommend it. Justin, how about you?
Yeah, a lot of the same thoughts there. Definitely, if you haven't seen Harvey and you are game, then get your butt into a seat or in front of a smartphone or however you watch this.
Or stand for 2 hours and watch it. Yeah.
Stand for 2 hours in the park, look up into the heavens, and you will see Harvey. You know, I'm with you, Travis. I can't recommend it enough. Check it out, people. I will take, since you brought it up, For me, my best Jimmy Stewart movie, like if you're going to look for a movie that has him in it being the most Jimmy Stewart-ish, for me, that although I have no problem with any of the other movies you mentioned, for me, that's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. So, and I don't know how much of that is just my bias because yeah. I grew up with a lot of Westerns. But to me, just the way that he exemplifies such a unique kind of strain of goodness in humanity. And it really, I don't know, when it's, I guess just because there's some different themes dealt with in that movie. But anyway, that's apropos, not of this episode. Gosh dang it, I'm letting the robbers win. We should get out of here, Travis. Little but rascals. I do have one more question before we go.
Yes.
And that is simply, what about Tom Brokaw?
Well, we have one more segment on the show. I failed to mention it at the top, but it's called Bad Letterboxd Reviews.
Bad Letterboxd Reviews.
Okay, Justin, this is the part of the show where I fire off some of my favorite finds. You can find these on the Twitter. You can find these on the Letterboxd itself if you have the movie rating app, which I know, Justin, you're a huge fan of social media, so you're like scanning these airwaves like crazy all the time.
I actually created the Insta book. So, yeah.
Is that a instant pot cookbook? Is that what that is?
It's a new form of nuclear weapon.
Well, now you're really talking about Instagram. Whoa! No, okay. Anyway, we bring you only the best and freshest societal commentary here, which is why the first Letterboxd review I want to read to you is about a film we've already mentioned on this show, which is Jordan Peele's 2017 joint Get Out. Okay, here's the review, Justin. Get Out 2017. 4 stars, 1 heart, because you know you can give that optional heart
right.
on top of the stars.
You let me know that. Yeah, okay.
Yes. This is the review. The least realistic part of this was that people willingly used Bing as a search engine.
Oh, yeah.
That is
You're
true,
pretty
though.
Good.
That's, yeah, I can't.
It's 2017, can't best, man. Jordan Peele, what are you doing?
Man, talk doing? About that rapid fire writing. I think Mrs. Chase probably wrote that comment review. Yeah.
What are you doing? Okay, all right. And the second one for today is for the pilot of a little television show, Justin, from 1990. Named Twin Peaks. Have you heard of it?
Yeah, maybe.
And this is a 2.5-star review. This is
I think they didn't like it.
Well, here's the review. I can't even tell, but 2.5 stars isn't great. Here's the review. Me running as fast as I can. I appreciate your style. I just don't get it. Please leave me alone. David Lynch galloping after me and playing a trumpet. Negativity is the enemy of creativity.
Yeah, you know what? I think that person actually gets it a lot more than their 2.5 stars lets on. That's a really accurate review. That review really puts me into the show and into the mind of David Lynch. Maybe the 2.5 stars is really like, we know Lynch loves numbers, so maybe they're just like, it's actually David. I bet it's just David up late at night, like, I know what would be a little bit funny. I'll leave a review and make it look like someone else didn't like the show, so I shouldn't do 4 stars. I don't even like 4.
It's out of 3.
I'm going to do 2.5 stars.
Yes, he gave his own pilot 2.5 out of 3 stars.
Right, but not because that means anything bad. You're not thinking like Lynch if you're thinking that way. It's no. 2.5 is the correct number for this review. So
I know
that's
some of you
are
hoping
there.
For 2.5. Yes. Okay, final Bad Letterboxd review of this episode before we say our bye-byes is a 1942 family classic called Bambi by the Walt Disney Corporation, which probably was a corporation at this point. I don't know. When does a corporation become a, I don't know things.
Become a conglomerate?
Yeah.
They're becoming a superpower.
Here it is. My stupid sister made me watch this. She is a little baby idiot who likes kid movies about animated deers and talking babies. It's super dumb. She doesn't even like adult movies. When I was a baby, I also liked these movies, but she should just grow up. I'm 12 now, and I watch movies with death and swearing words. She is 10 and doesn't even watch movies with guns. So stupid.
Yeah, so it sounds like he's leaving a review for his sister, really, not for Bambi. But my sister, also, that stars. Is just its own like subgenre of commentary I've noticed on YouTube and on my Instabook. Hashtag bring it disco style.
Yeah, that's
I'm pretty sure I used that all accurately and that's all real. But there is this definite trend of people that I've noticed will leave a comment like on a let's say it's a Bee Gees song, right? Sure. And they'll be like, wow, awesome Bee Gees comment. And then, you know, the next comment is like, I'm 10 years old and I like this music. And it's like, what? Okay. I mean, great. That's wonderful, you know? But then it becomes like this. I don't even think these people are 10. I think it's the robbers that are leaving these comments.
Maybe the robbers are 10, Justin.
I'm 3 years old and I love Tarantino. It's like, no, I don't think that you have any idea. I even saw for podcasts, Travis,
yes,
some kid supposedly, allegedly, child left a review for Conan. Like,
yeah.
I'm 7 and I really enjoy this show. It's like, wow, I don't think you're the intended audience. That doesn't sound correct.
They just like
anyway, so yeah, it's just, yeah. It's a weird, it is happening. It's happening.
It's happening, and we're going to take it home. Here we go. All right, so not only did we review Harvey, we hit Bambi, Get Out, and
Twin Peaks.
So we did a great job. Next week, we are going to have one of our favorite guests on. It's Annie.
She's
coming back. We should have an It's Annie jingle. Oh my gosh, that would be great.
That would be.
We're going to be doing Sabrina, which is a Humphrey Bogart, Audrey Hepburn flick. I've never seen it. Justin, have you?
Me neither. No, but it should be a lot of fun. And until then, goodbye. And I'm looking for Tom Brokaw.
I'll run away now. Goodbye.
Let the movie speak.
Perhaps you'd like to dance, Miss Kelly.
All right, Mr. Dowd, if you'd like to.
I used to dance. I haven't danced in years. I'm sure Dr. Sanderson would love to dance with somebody as lovely as you.
Would you, Miss Kelly?
All right.